newspaperman meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis where you have some veteran local journalists talking about issues in the media, making the case for ethical decision-making in journalism, and noting how local journalism actually has echoes in what we see nationally. So that's our charge here, and that's what we're about. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union, now publishing the Upstate American on Substack. And I am here with two other former editors, Judy Patrick, who was the editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady, and Barbara Lombardo, longtime editor of the Saratogian and executive editor of the Record in Troy. How y'all doing?
Good. So far, so good.
You know, so back at it and still riled up.
Yeah, all right. Riled up. This will get you going because since we were last in this studio, we had the White House Correspondents' Dinner, the Redux, that is, because the original fancy White House Correspondents' Dinner was, of course, disrupted when a guy charged through the security station with a drawn weapon. So this was much smaller, one-third the number of people, none of the big advanced cocktail parties. But still, Donald Trump came to speak, first time he's appeared at the WHCD, as it's called. And I just want you all to think about this. I'll read you two headlines, and then I'd like your reaction. First, Brian Stelter, who writes about the press for CNN, said Trump bombed at the White House Correspondents' Dinner and proved its point. Tom Jones of the Poynter Institute, a journalism think tank, said the White House Correspondents' Dinner was an embarrassment. Do we agree?
I don't think it proved the point. I think Stelter's position was that it proved that the freedom of the press is alive and well, that we are able to criticize the president and come together. Hogwash. This was vile, dangerous, debasing. I fault the president for his incredibly dangerous comments about the press. And I also condemn the White House correspondents who sat there and took it, and everyone in the audience who didn't get up and walk away. I remain convinced that this dinner is a bad idea. It was bad under Obama, Biden, Clinton, and it's even worse under Trump. The idea that the reporters get together and do fake glam, they want to hang out on a red carpet with celebrities, I hate this. I have really thought about why I'm so upset about this. And I think it's because I like to think of journalism as a working class enterprise. And this tries to elevate reporters to an elite status. And I think it undermines our position with the American public and it undermines trust in the press.
Wonderfully, powerfully, passionately put. Do you think, by the way, that one of the reasons why that working class thing is seen differently in Washington is because so many of the participants in the White House Correspondents' Dinner are television reporters, not print reporters, and they see their role differently? They are in showbiz, aren't they?
They are indeed in show business. And I heard the president of the White House Correspondents Association do this wonderful little riff about how important the First Amendment was. It's a token nod. If you want to raise money for scholarships for journalism students, raise money for scholarships for journalism students. I looked at the 990. This dinner cost $500,000 just for the hotel rental. In previous years, they paid about $40,000 or $50,000 for the entertainment. So if you want to raise money, have a luncheon, give out some awards. Stop renting the sequin gowns and the tuxedos.
Judy, you helped me come and see the light. I used to think that what is wrong with having journalists and legislators and politicians convening in a room and being able to laugh at yourself, to have a sense of humor, to show that you're all people, even though when you're on the clock, you're also in adversarial positions. It used to be considered a perk to get to go, hey, I got to go to the, not me personally, if you get to go to this event that this, oh, you're somebody special. And now, oh my God, you said it much better with lots of good facts to back up your position there.
She did some reporting, didn't she? That's pretty great.
Yes.
We're dopes. We are dopes to sit through that. You wouldn't have anybody invited to speak at an event that you're holding who wants to destroy you, who has called you the enemy of the American people, who is trying to undermine you, who is suing you left and right. We are idiots in the media to put up with that. I think it's great for journalists to celebrate the good work of our peers, and that can be done, but this has got to go.
I want to play for you the comments of the president of the White House Correspondents Association, Weizhi Zhang, a CBS News correspondent, because the point is made by one of our listeners, Bruce in Hubbardsville, wrote to us and said, "I am disappointed in the press who attended and upset that they did not respond to Trump's slurs and jokes. Based on an online search this morning, the stories about the event were tepid at best, treating it as business as usual." So I just want to hear a little bit of what Weizhi Zhang said as the president sat right there, as correspondents were being recognized for some of the stories that took him to task that he hated. Here at least is a bit of the courage, I would say, of one reporter.
There is a difference, though, an existential difference between criticizing the press and trying to undermine it. One is healthy and it makes all of us better. The other is exactly what the founders hoped to prevent. Around the world, press freedom is not guaranteed. In many countries, reporters who criticize the government are detained without trial, their stories erased. In the worst cases, they never make it home. Tonight, we think about all of them, and we think about the protections that set us apart as a nation. Just 20 days ago, America turned 250 years old. The First Amendment is a big part of how she made it this far, and it falls on all of us to make sure it carries her through to the next 250 and beyond.
All right, now the question is, does that make a difference? Does saying what she did about differentiating between criticism of the press and trying to undermine the press, will that have any impact? Or isn't, to your point, isn't the message lost in the very visual impact of all these reporters sitting down, hobnobbing with the hoi polloi?
It's a token nod. It's a tepid response. And do you think Donald Trump, that registered at all with him? Of course not. The event itself overshadows any token effort to put a plug in for the First Amendment and to make the important points that need to be made. A more important way of doing that would have been to stand up and walk out.
I think that, as Barbara alluded to, there has been something of a change in tone over the years, partly due, not just entirely, but partly due to the fact that Donald Trump is so much more outrageous than any of his predecessors, that he is, in fact, not just contesting facts with the press, but he is trying to undermine the free press. But there is a question as to whether this was ever a good idea. Now, I'm coming around to this, I must say. I'm somebody who was a part of the Legislative Correspondents Association. I sang in 16 LCA shows when I was younger, before my wife, I became the editor of the Times Union, said, you've grown out of that, haven't you? I've attended the White House Correspondents' Dinner. I've attended other ones. The Gridiron in Washington is white tie. You actually have to rent tails and everything for that. That's ridiculous. But I did that at the invitation of Hearst Newspapers. And I've come to think that this is not a good idea. The New York Times decided against participating in the Legislative Correspondents Association about a decade ago. And other media have not followed so much here in Albany. The show is much less than what it used to be. There used to be costumes and an orchestra, and people paid $200 a ticket. And now it's a much smaller event on a weeknight. But I think we may be in a situation now where we've outgrown the ability to have this kind of interaction.
Not just outgrown. Some of us have wised up.
Yeah, and often with these big events, what you'll see is not really reporters networking with sources, but you'll see lobbyists, politicians, media moguls, and celebrities. Even if you do a search and search for images, reporters hanging out with Aretha Franklin or sports celebrities, it's all about the glam, and it's not about recognizing reporters. I know that's probably a more boring event and they're not going to draw celebrities in, but that's not what journalism is about.
It's a really good point. I need to make the point about the participation. It is not just reporters who get involved in this. There are celebrities. You're right. At the end of the Gridiron Dinner, the tradition is everybody stands and links arms across your chest, right hand to the left and left hand to the right, and you sing.
I'm getting creeped out here.
Here you go. You're right. You sing Auld Lang Syne. And I sang Auld Lang Syne with the Secretary of the Navy on my left and Jimmy Hoffa on my right, the live one, not his dad. And I realized how uncomfortable that was. What a difficult situation. And of course, I thought, gosh, this is kind of cool, but it's not, in fact. I think you make a very good point that it's actually ugly.
And even though most other politicians are able to put on a good face and display decorum and be sometimes generous and thoughtful in their remarks, I think they still cringe at having to rub elbows at those kind of events and attend the events. They feel like they need to go, they're supposed to go, and we need more journalists to feel the same way.
Yeah, very good point. Listeners, if you are interested in commenting on this, we'd love to hear from you. media@wamc.org is how you tell us. We're all saying this is a tradition whose time has passed. We'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Media, don't you think most normal people don't give a hoot about this event? I think we wring our hands about it a lot internally. And I think our letter writer mentions that because we're not supposed to be part of the elite.
Absolutely. Okay, on to something else big that has happened since we last sat here in Studio D, and that is the Trump administration has dropped its subpoenas against New York Times journalists. You will recall, listeners, that what was at stake here was several New York Times reporters were served subpoenas, some of them actually with FBI agents knocking on the door of their homes in an effort to find out who was leaking information about the security concerns of the new Air Force One that was given to Donald Trump by Qatar. And the Justice Department, after the Times, took them to court and asked a judge to quash the subpoenas, making the point that discovery was coming. That is, when you've got a lawsuit, the people who are the targets of the lawsuit get a chance to delve into all sorts of information that you might not like. So the Justice Department said it's going to withdraw the subpoenas and back off the case entirely. So I guess we could have predicted this is going to happen. But the fact of the matter is, this happened to the New York Times, which has vast resources, lots of lawyers on staff. This kind of attack on the media is significant for the impact it could have on others who aren't that powerful.
And the administration is not saying, oh, I guess we were wrong in doing this. They just took their marbles, collected them to go home and said, curses foiled again. We're going to find another way. They will be looking for workarounds to avoid this kind of a mess. If they had done things in a different order, the outcome might have been different. We should not be celebrating yet. To me, this was the only sensible legal outcome of this particular instance. But we are, in the media, are going to be targeted continually. And I would not be the least bit surprised to see them still going after these reporters, but just doing things in the order that they were supposed to be doing them.
Won the battle, but not the war. I think they looked at the writing on the wall and saw that these subpoenas were flawed because the rule, the process is you have to try to find the information out lots of other different ways before you turn to a reporter as a last result. And the fact that these subpoenas were issued within a day or two of the stories clearly showed that they hadn't done any investigation beforehand. I think they may even go back at these subpoenas in another way after they've done some cursory investigation to kind of prove that they are following the process. But yeah, the continued effort to undermine the press's efforts, especially when it comes to using anonymous sources or accessing information the government doesn't want us to know, which is almost every piece of information, will continue unabated.
Yeah, and Todd Blanche, the acting attorney general, has made it clear that he is not backing off of this kind of an issue. He isn't unwilling to do this again. So I expect you're right. I think we're going to see more of this, and we will see it around the country. There was a similar action out in central New York involving small news organizations just recently where a subpoena was withdrawn under strong defense mounted by a local counsel. So this can happen. You can beat back these subpoenas, but it takes energy and finances. It takes the money to be able to afford these lawyers. And a lot of these small news organizations simply don't have that.
And these subpoenas are bad, once again, because what they tell the public is that you can't trust the reporter to keep your information secret, that it will make it less likely that people will go to reporters and give them information that could get them into trouble because they aren't supposed to divulge it. And again, the point often is that this information really should be public, and the government is unjustifiably withholding it. And if it wasn't for these kinds of whistleblowers, we would be in the dark about important social and governmental issues.
I think we all, in our reporting careers and as editors, have really relied upon unnamed sources, upon people who are talking to us when officially they weren't supposed to be. And if we didn't have those people doing that, if we have, that is, more local officials aping Donald Trump and taking aim at anybody who talks to the media and who tries to go after reporters to get that information, there's a lot of information that we won't know about local, county, state government, and we will be the poorer for it.
We were against this even when Joe Biden and Barack Obama did it. It's just that under President Trump, it's just so much more intense.
That's true, as is almost everything. The Media Project from Northeast Public Radio is who we are. I'm Rex Smith here with Judy Patrick and Barbara Lombardo. We talk about what's going on in journalism this week, and we bring the perspective of years of running local newsrooms. One of the complaints that local newsrooms sometimes have is that bigger newsrooms swoop in and take the stories that you've worked on.
No, no kidding.
The greatest example of that, of course, is the most successful television program in history, 60 Minutes. And 60 Minutes does these wonderful 13-minute long video segments that air on broadcast TV. It has been legendary for decades, and now it is upended. They have, under the CBS News presidency of Barry Weiss, the show's previous executive producer was taken out, along with correspondents Sharon Alfonsi, Cecilia Vega, Scott Pelley was fired. Anderson Cooper decided he wasn't going to stay. So they need to have a whole new cast. And this past week, the new cast was announced. And I just want to get your reaction, media projectors, as to what you think about that. One of the correspondents will be Ross Douthat, the conservative New York Times columnist. He's leaving what is such an amazing post as a conservative columnist in the New York Times. The author, Sebastian Junger, who wrote The Perfect Storm, a remarkable piece, and actually helped define participant observation journalism. He really went in depth into that kind of reporting. Trevor Phillips is actually Sir Trevor Phillips. He's a Brit who has been hired initially to be an international correspondent, and now they've announced that he's going to be a 60 Minutes correspondent, and a young filmmaker named Gianna Toboni. So this is a new thing, and I'm just wondering how we're feeling about these people are described as entrepreneurial journalists who understand how to reach modern audiences. How do you reach modern audiences? Good question. What do you suppose they have that the others didn't have?
I'm willing to give them a shot. I'll tune in for a couple of weeks, but I don't have high expectations. It seems like they're totally changing the show. It seems like it will no longer be the 60 Minutes that has been built up over generations. That I had a recipe for or format that presented important information in a distilled, captivating way. And it's also television. And I'm not sure the talents that these people have is going to translate into captivating television. What I've seen with Barry Weiss, what she's done with CBS News has not been impressive so far. I'm worried that it's going to be a little bit like Good Morning America and not so much like 60 Minutes.
Yeah, the deep reporting can be done in 13-minute segments on television. We talk about TV being superficial, but when you've got 13 minutes on the air, you can do really significant reporting, and 60 Minutes over the years has.
That requires a lot more than 13 minutes worth of investment in reporting to then turn that into a 13-minute show. So I'm in the fingers crossed, and let's see. They're moving ahead with this, so let's see what they do with it.
Yeah. I think the difficulty that we are faced with, the suspicion, is because Barry Weiss is alleged to be Trump-friendly, let's say. She is certainly, she left the New York Times opinion column page after just a few months with a blast saying it was too left, too set in its ways. And the fact that Donald Trump has welcomed her appointment and that she has brought on all kinds of opinion journalists and that she has never herself covered a story. She's never been a reporter. All good reasons to be suspicious of what's going on at 60 Minutes.
Skeptical.
Skeptical. There you go. A good journalistic trait all the way around, right? All the time. Love to hear your thoughts on that, folks. Media, WAMC.org. Okay, we have to talk about AI because AI is what we have to talk about in journalism these days because it is everywhere. And the question is, what is appropriate in terms of using AI and how you need to reveal that? Because the question is, do you need to have a little line on every column saying, we used AI in the presentation and the preparation of this report? Or is that just, we used a Google search in the preparation of this? What's the answer to that?
And I think if you put a line like we used AI in the present in the creation of this, people will just glance over it. It will be meaningless. I think what people need to do is have a tagline, which would be words at the end of whatever they've done, explaining exactly what they did. Did they use it to analyze financial data? Did they use it to help with the headline writing? That kind of more helpful information would definitely be more productive than just like a slug. I'm using jargon, I'm sorry.
Slug, yes. Now tell people what a slug is. Yeah,
it's a short name at the top of a story. But I think just putting one line on is not going to help. What I'm seeing is news organizations have different approaches to how they're using AI in their work. Some are using it for really advancing how fast they do things. Others are being careful about how often they use AI to replace people and to give that some value in their consideration of what they do. I think even a page on the website that explains, this is our approach to AI, this is what we want to do and how we feel it will be valuable to you, the consumer of our news.
I thought that where it might be useful would be if companies that are using AI to write stories that they've stolen the material for and it's being rewritten, or they just have fed material into AI and then publishing whatever it's spitting out. That could help legitimate outlets if people see that and it matters to them that it says this story was written by AI.
Now, I use AI when I'm writing. I will divulge here. I write every week the Upstate American, and it goes out in Substack, which is basically an email platform. And I would always do research using the Google machine, right? You just check on some things to try to get some facts to back things up. Now, of course, that has been folded in. You can't just Google something. They now give you AI answers instead of the actual citations. Then you have to dig deeper to get to the actual citations. I find that it's very helpful in helping some of my thinking get a little bit sharpened. But you wouldn't ever use it for your writing.
So you're saying you're using it to let it question what you've come up with,
yes.
And it makes you think harder about, did I address this or that?
Precisely. I actually enter my thesis. It's about X as revealed and Y as to be told in a column. So I actually write it in and see what it says about that. And sometimes it'll give me a source that I hadn't thought of.
So how do you tell your readers that you've done this, or do you do that at all?
I use footnotes.
Okay.
Because then I have to go deeper into it. I have to get the actual source material, not AI, so that I footnote the sources or cite them. But I am led to those sources by AI, and I think that's okay.
So I think it is, too. I think that it's what a smart editor would be doing for you. Hey, here's what I'm thinking about writing, or here's what I've written so far. What do you think? And the editor could then point out things and then just say, hey, why don't you check into this, that, or the other thing? The advantage with AI is that it's going to be able to come up with even more places to look or things to consider that an editor may not have at their fingertips.
But you need to understand that too heavy a reliance on that offers you a limited landscape or potentially a incorrect landscape. There have been studies that show 45% of the time, news search will give you at least one bad fact. And now we've heard that Meta has reached an agreement with Newsmax.
Terrible.
As a primary news source. And that is going to generate news content that is far right, incorrect, slanted, biased. Please do not use that, Rex, in your household.
It's outrageous. I think you're exactly right. This is a significant development. Meta is, quote, draw upon Newsmax's significant current reporting as well as archive content across its platforms to support AI queries. And this is terrifying, actually, because information is not, in fact, neutral. Information is sometimes false, sometimes true. It is nuanced, and to have AI simply absorb this stuff from Newsmax, which is intentionally biased and often quite wrong, in fact. Newsmax is one of the defendants who had to pay up after the last election because of the lies of Donald Trump. That is really serious. NewsGuard, which ranks the credibility and reliability of news outlets, gave Newsmax 20 out of 100.
That's failing.
That is definitely.
I'm no math major.
You're a reporter, right?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that is frightening.
And it's not just AI. That would cross over into Facebook and Instagram, all the Meta products, which are vast. So watch out, folks.
Absolutely. I would stay away from Meta products if you can while you're using AI, if you're searching for things, and if you don't go after that next step, go for the source material. Which means we are out of time today. How about that? This just zipped right along, folks. Again, we would love to hear from you, media@wamc.org, and we will share your views with our listeners on the next show. Barb Lombardo is here. Judy Patrick, I'm Rex Smith. We are grateful to the producer of the Media Project, David Gustina. Mostly, though, we thank you for joining us this week and hope you come back again next week for the Media Project.
Such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's aunt. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, hold the press. Extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling, ling-a-ling-a-ling. Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette and former vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association, and Raga Justin, Albany Bureau Chief for Bloomberg Government. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.